for the forecast.
It's 10 after 6. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. Well, imagine a presidential election where one party put up a Southern candidate, and this candidate was constantly being accused of various infidelities and other sexual innuendo was used. Think it was a recent election? Well, guess what? The candidate in question was Thomas Jefferson. He still got his head on the quarter anyway. We're going to talk about presidential dirty tricks and political cheap shots and October surprises in U.S. presidential campaigns. Seems pretty appropriate to do that, considering we're in the midst of a campaign. There's a new book out called Anything for a Vote, Dirty Tricks, Cheap Shots, and October Surprises in U.S. Presidential Campaigns. And we have the author of that book with us, Joseph Cummins, a historian and freelance writer, is joining us by telephone. Good morning and welcome to the program.
Good morning, John. Thank you for having me.
Well, first of all, what gave you the idea to do this book?
Well, I think, you know, what really gave me the idea was shortly after the 2004 election, and I was listening to all the pundits throwing up their hands and saying things like, oh, you know, this is the dirtiest election ever, and is democracy going to survive the swift boat Veterans for Truth, and, you know, all that kind of thing. And I thought to myself, well, we keep saying that our elections are getting dirtier and dirtier. Let me go back in history all the way back to 1789, to the very first American presidential campaign, and see if that's the case. And, in fact, it turns out that they're not really getting any dirtier. They're pretty much just as dirty as they've always been, and in some cases, they're really not quite as bad as they were.
Well, there were, there have been just some absolutely horrendous things done during presidential campaigns, the 19th century was a pretty nasty time for people running for high political office.
Well, it was actually pretty bad, and one of the reasons was that we were more of a rough and tumble society at that time, and I think we were willing to attack people, you know, more viciously. I mean, you mentioned the election of 1800, where John Adams ran against Thomas Jefferson, and they accused Jefferson of all kind of sexual infidelities and things like that. But on the other hand, Jefferson, who is one of our founding fathers, and who I think we sometimes look at through rose-colored glasses, hired a writer to attack John Adams as, quote, a repulsive pedant, unquote, and a hideous hermaphrodite, and claimed that his vice presidential candidate had actually gone to England and gotten four mistresses and brought them back to America and kept two for himself and gave two to John. So the attacks went both ways, and it went on from there. It just got worse and worse during the course of that century. I mean, we have the blogosphere these days where a lot of some of the more scurrilous rumors are reported on the campaign, but they had the 19th century version of the blogosphere, which was the pamphlets and the handbills. The printing press became very much in use at that time, and they kept churning out these things. So you had cases like in 1836 where Davy Crockett, who we think of as our famous frontier hero, actually was a congressman who attacked Martin Van Buren for supposedly wearing women's clothing. And, you know, it was one of these cases where this was, of course, completely untrue. Like JFK, Van Buren wore corsets laced around his waist to help his bad back, but that was about it. But these things just kept on getting worse and worse.
Well, in 1864, George McClellan, who was running for president against Abraham Lincoln, described Lincoln as nothing more than a well-meaning baboon.
Yeah, well, here's another case of an iconic figure in American history who we, of course, don't really think of as being attacked. But here, McClellan, who was Lincoln's former general and who really had a hatred for Lincoln for firing him, says he's nothing more than a well-meaning baboon, compares him to a quote-unquote nutmeg dealer skulking through the alleyways, nutmeg being a supposed aphrodisiac, or that's what they thought in the 19th century. And even when that didn't work, he claimed that Lincoln had smelly feet. that he didn't change his socks for a week at a time.
Smelly feet.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know.
Well, boy, no, that's really hitting below the belt. We're going to take a quick break, and then when we come back, I want to start going through what you list as the top 10 dirtiest American presidential campaigns of all time. And I think people will be amazed at how many of them took place before 1900. So there's really nothing new under the sun. Somebody famous said that, I think. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll take your phone calls as well at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. That's a toll-free number. And if you're in Madison, please use 263-1890, 263-1890. I'm John Munson. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 7:17. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's what's coming up a little bit later on today on the Ideas Network. The Family and Medical Leave Act was passed in 1993. 15 years later, what are some of the efforts to expand and limit protections to American workers? After 5, Ben Marins and his guest discuss the future of unpaid medical leave. That's coming up later today on the Ideas Network. This hour, we're talking about some nasty politics in presidential elections, and we have the author of a new book about that very topic, Joseph Cummins, historian and freelance writer, and his most recent book is Anything for a Vote, Dirty Tricks, Cheap Shots, and October Surprises in U.S. Presidential Campaigns. Well, earlier today, in the billboard for this program, I said that the if you would finish this hour knowing the top 10 dirtiest presidential campaigns of all time, or my name isn't John Munson, so we better get to that, or I'm going to have to change my name to George. Okay, here we go. Let's see. Oh, you know what? I misspoke. Jefferson is on the nickel, not the quarter. Okay, well, a quarter is worth about a nickel these days, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
So you have this top 10 list of the dirtiest American presidential campaigns of all time. Let's start with 1828. It's Andrew Jackson squaring off against John Quincy Adams.
Yes, he's running against John Quincy, the son of John Adams, and you really couldn't find two guys who were really more dissimilar, because of course Jackson was the frontier hero and the guy who fought duels for his honor, and John Quincy Adams was much more the intellectual New Englander, and Jackson of course represented America as it moved west, and Quincy was the old Federalist persuasion of Massachusetts and Connecticut and New York. And this was an extremely dirty election in which Jackson, who had admittedly fought a couple of duels, was accused of killing at least 100 men in a duel. He was accused of being a bigamist because he and his wife Rachel had gotten married before her previous marriage had been annulled, although they believed in good faith that this marriage had already been annulled. And these were some very, very serious attacks. Some of them were more humorous. They claimed that Jackson didn't know how to spell Europe, and spelled it Europe, beginning with U, and they basically went at each other tooth and nail, and finally Jackson won, but he never forgave his opponents in this election because Rachel, who had had a heart condition, died shortly before his inauguration, and he blamed the attacks on her for her premature and untimely death.
And during the campaign, the incumbent president, Adams, not the one who was running, was lambasted as a pimp and an uncaring aristocrat. I mean, they didn't really mince any words there, did they?
Well, they certainly did not. And this is a case, and this happens these days, too. Now, this instance of calling him a pimp, what really happened was when he was ambassador to Russia before he became president, he introduced one of his wife's lady's maids to the Tsar of Russia. And that small incident, where just this sort of formal introduction caused his opponents to blow it up into this big thing where, in fact, he was actually pimping by giving the Tsar of Russia this lady's maid, which was far from the truth, but it stuck. I mean, one of the things that I say in the book is that no matter how far-fetched you and I may believe some of these accusations are, negative campaigning works because some kernel of it tends to stick to a lot of people if they are predisposed to believe that way.
So that's number 10. I hope people are taking notes now, so you remember these. Number 10 is Andrew Jackson versus John Quincy Adams in 1828. Then we jump forward. Number 9 on the list is 1960, John F. Kennedy and Richard Nixon. My parents almost got divorced during that election because my father was heavily in favor of Nixon and my mother supported Kennedy. It was a lot of strife in the household.
Well, you know what? In my household, that was exactly the opposite. And in 1960, I was 10 years old, and I remember my mother coming in the room the morning after that very close election, flipping on the lights and waking my brother and myself up and saying, "Your friend Kennedy won." And she was very upset by that. And, in fact, it was one of the closest elections in American history. It was an interesting election because not a lot of people know this, but Kennedy and Nixon had actually been good friends. They'd served in the Congress and in the Senate together. And this election really broke apart these two former war veterans. And one of the things that really happened was directly on Election Day itself because, the very respected journalist Tom Wicker has said, "We still don't know who won that election." There's a lot of reports that it was stolen in Cook County, Illinois, by Richard Daley, who was the Democratic boss at that time, and who called up Kennedy that night and said, "Well, you're going to win this election with a little help from your friends." There's a lot more reports that, in fact, that the election was stolen in Texas, which was the home state of Kennedy's running mate, Lyndon Johnson, and where the voting machines were rigged so that if you were a Democrat and you voted once, it would actually register two or three votes for your candidate. And I like to say this was the election where dead men walked the land because there were a lot of dead people voting in that election on the Democratic side. Nixon chose not to contest that election. And I think, interestingly, I think this had an effect on the election of 1972. He had so many dirty tricks aimed against him that I think he felt now was his time for payback. And in 1972, the Watergate election, that's what happened.
Well, I think we have a caller who wants to address that issue. So let's bring in Steve from La Crosse. Steve, good morning. Thanks for holding.
Good morning, gentlemen. I just wanted to reinforce that 1960 and 1972 are very much related in my mind. And I'm old enough to vaguely remember 1960, but 72 really sticks out in my mind. And I'm wondering, why would anyone bug an opponent's headquarters and risk, you know, the whole election and the embarrassment of it, just to get some information from the Democratic National Committee? That's not even where you would plant a bug. So there was a lot of weird stuff going on in 72, but I think it had to do with Nixon's feeling that the Kennedys and the Democratic Party were doing it to him in 1960, was just payback.
You're absolutely right, and I think I'd like to sort of say that dirty tricks in presidential politics goes in eras, and my book is a very nonpartisan book because both parties have been guilty of this. 1960 was the great era of the Democratic dirty trick, and I think what happened was, as I said, and as you're saying, Nixon said, "You know what? They're doing this to me. Why can't I do this to them?" And even though Robert Kennedy was dead and JFK was dead, Teddy Kennedy was still very much alive and a power in the Democratic Party. And this, in some ways, some historians believe, was directed still at the Kennedys. I mean, after Watergate, Nixon said, I couldn't muster much moral outrage over what was just another political bugging. And people felt that he was being disingenuous when he said that. But, in fact, I don't think he was. I think he really believed it was just another political bugging.
Well, and really, by the standards of some other campaigns, that one wasn't even particularly noteworthy, considering some of the other things that are included in your book. Well, we'll talk more about Richard Nixon and George McGovern in that 72 campaign, because that is in the top 10. The next up, number 8. So number 10 was 1828, then number 9 was the 1960 campaign. And then number 8 was the 1928 campaign. Herbert Hoover basically destroyed Al Smith.
He destroys Al Smith, and he's the Republican candidate running against Al Smith, who is the governor of New York, and who was also the very first Catholic candidate. And that played seriously into this election because people, as we can see, even when Mitt Romney was running, they have a very difficult time in America accepting different faiths and different religions when these people are running for president. William Howard Taft, not many people know this, William Howard Taft was a Unitarian, and in 1908 he was attacked pretty viciously because he was a Unitarian. So Al Smith was really attacked for being a Catholic, and one of the things that they put out against him, which may sound ridiculous, but it actually worked, was that he presided over the building of the Holland Tunnel in New York, which goes from Massachusetts to New Jersey, but his Republican opponents claimed, in fact, that the tunnel had not been dug to New Jersey. It had really been dug 3,500 miles underneath the Atlantic Ocean and came up underneath the Vatican. So Smith would secretly meet with the Pope underneath the Vatican and get his marching orders.
So you can fool some of the people all of the time.
Exactly, exactly. And if you were someone in the rural South and the rural West who'd never been to New York and was suspicious of Catholics, you might and did very well believe this.
Okay, so that's 1928, Hoover versus Smith. The next one is, we jump all the way into the 21st century. Number seven on your list is the 2004 election, George W. Bush versus John Kerry.
Yeah, and here we have an election that isn't quite as controversial as 2000, but I think I list it as one of my maybe three or four possibly stolen elections in American history because of what happened in Ohio, because at that time, if he had Kerry been able to win Ohio, he could have won the election, but there were a lot of voting irregularities in Ohio. And I think this is the way elections can be stolen these days, and it's something we should watch out for in 2008. In other words, instead of it being like the 1880s where they would send a bag man full of hundreds of thousands of dollars of cash to steal elections, you have the Secretary of the State, J. Kenneth Blackwell, trying to disenfranchise voters by making it very difficult for people in urban areas who were mainly Democrats to vote. He changed the laws regarding the paper stock that ballot registrations were printed on and retroactively caused 30,000 people to be disenfranchised in the greater Cleveland area alone. And there were a number of incidents like this in the state of Ohio, which may very well have cost us, the Democrats, the election. And the other dirty trick in that election, of course, was the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth attacks on John Kerry as not a war hero, as someone who was falsifying his war record. And I think this has lessons that can be taught to people today, particularly Barack Obama, if he feels that he's being negatively attacked by Hillary Clinton. I think that he needs to respond very, very aggressively to these negative attacks because John Kerry did not respond aggressively to the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth attacks, and I think to his peril, he found out that was the wrong tactic.
Well, he and probably some other people just thought, well, this is so unbelievable. I'm not going to elevate this by speaking of it. And as you say, that turned out to be a very grave error on his part.
Yes, indeed.
We're just about at news time, so we're not going to go any further right now, but plenty more to come. So just to recap, we have in the top 10, the number 10 was Jackson versus John Quincy Adams. Number 9, John F. Kennedy versus Richard Nixon. Number 8, Herbert Hoover versus Al Smith. And number 7, George W. Bush versus John Kerry. We'll go through the rest of the top 10, and we'll take some of your calls as well at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. In Madison, it's 263-1890. We're talking about dirty politics in presidential elections this hour here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 7:35. I'm John Munson, and for Joy Cardine this week on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we're discussing the book Anything for a Vote, Dirty Tricks, Cheap Shots, and October Surprises in U.S. Presidential Campaigns. And we have the author, Joseph Cummins, joining us by telephone, and you can too at 800-642-1234 or 263-1890. We left off of our top 10 dirtiest American presidential campaigns of all time with number 7. And let's see, we have a caller on the line who wants to make a comment about that. Let's go to Doug in New Berlin. Doug, good morning.
Good morning, sir, and good morning, Mr. Cummins.
Good morning, Doug.
My question is, regarding the Swift Boat incident in the 2004 election, it's my understanding that John Kerry promised he was going to release his military records, and as of today's date, he never has. Would that not have debunked the situation? And I'll take my comment off the air. Thank you.
Well, I'm not sure that that would have debunked the situation because there were so many attacks coming at him in so many different directions from the Swift boat veterans. So I think even just the bare facts of his military record probably wouldn't have done that, although it probably would have been a good idea. I think he resented the fact that he would have to do that, and I think it probably would have been a good idea for him to have done that. But as you say, he delayed in doing that.
Okay, number six on our top ten list, 1988, George H.W. Bush versus Michael Dukakis.
Yeah, this is really one of the dirtiest elections in the latter part of the 20th century. And, of course, it's the first George Bush against the Massachusetts governor, Michael Dukakis. And there's no way that Dukakis is going to beat Bush, who had served as Reagan's vice president. But even so, Lee Atwater, who was Bush's campaign manager, decides that he wants to pursue a campaign of what he calls, quote, raising the negatives, unquote. And in many ways, this campaign is the model for campaigns to come in the next 20 years. And in many ways, what this campaign was based upon was fear. So Dukakis happened to be governor of Massachusetts when a furlough program was put in place for Massachusetts prisoners. In other words, if you were a prisoner, even accused of a serious crime, you could be let out for weekend furloughs. One of those candidates, whose name was William Horton, was let out from prison, and he ended up raping a white woman and stabbing her white fiancé. And these colors matter because Lee Atwater and the Republicans turned this into a commentary on race. And they started putting out a lot of ads calling William Horton Willie, which is quite interesting because his name is actually William, and he was known to everyone as William. But suddenly he becomes Willie. And they had famous commercials such as the revolving door ads where people went around in circles indoors, and this was supposed to show that Dukakis was soft on crime. They even claimed that the Chicago serial killer John Wayne Gacy would be released from jail if Dukakis became president, which caused what I call the only concern letter from a serial killer to the Republican National Committee in history, where John Wayne Gacy writes and says, "How dare you use my good name to smear the Democratic candidate?"
His good name, indeed.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, now we go from Bush versus Dukakis to 1972, and we already talked about this a little bit, so let's just get the bare bones and move on. But this is the famous Richard Nixon versus George McGovern campaign. And I'm not so sure in this case whether any of the Watergate or any of the dirty tricks in that campaign really would have made a difference, because McGovern pretty much shot himself in the foot a number of times in that campaign anyway.
Well, he shot himself in the foot with the Senator Thomas Eagleton incident, where it was found out that Senator Eagleton had had some treatments for for nervous exhaustion in his background, and McGovern claimed to be behind him, quote, 1,000%, unquote, and then dropped him as a running mate pretty quickly. I'm sorry, I have a cold today. But Nixon was going to win this campaign by a lot. But because, as we said earlier, he still had some scores to settle with the Democrats, he allowed a group of people to perform a lot of dirty tricks, not just bugging the Watergate headquarters of the Democratic National Committee, but sending people out during the primaries to attack his main opponent, who was Edward Muskie, plant false charges in a newspaper that Muskie had used slurs when referring to French Canadians, and also claiming that Muskie's wife was an alcoholic, which caused Muskie during a press conference in New Hampshire to start crying out of frustration, although he claimed wasn't really crying. It was a snowflake in his eye. But in this particular case, crying in New Hampshire worked, and Nixon's main opponent was shot down.
I have an update here on the John Kerry records issue. According to the Boston Globe, in June of 2005, John Kerry did release his military records.
So, he did. I actually didn't know that. So.
Well, that's why we have producers to look up these things.
Well, it didn't do him.
It didn't help. No, it didn't help, because that story was out there. We have an email from Elsie in Milwaukee. Too bad the foundation was laid so long ago. What does that say about the country? The thing is, Let's see. That is way in the past, not everyone read or subscribed to media, and there was not as much, certainly as now, an instant effect. But there was a different kind of media in the 18th and 19th centuries, and people did look at it, and they talked to each other.
Oh, and they talked to each other, and newspapers were very, very big, much more so than today. Newspapers were blatantly for one candidate or another, and we're willing to print almost anything to attack the opposing candidate. And let me just quickly say that I think what it says about our country is that we're a democracy. This is where all this is going. We do these things. There are dirty tricks. There are all kinds of nasty stuff going on because we're a highly competitive bunch of people, and we do these things to try to win. We don't live in a country where there's only one party and only one person gets to be the president, the head of the country. You know, it's only part of human nature, and this is what I try to point out in the book, that we do these things. We may not like them. We may abhor what some of these candidates are doing, but it's part of who we are as a nation, and I think we need to understand that.
Okay, let's move on here. And we did talk about this next election already, so we don't need to do too much more about it. But the number four on your list is the 1800 election with Jefferson versus John Adams, and that was pretty nasty.
And that was very nasty, yes. Yeah.
Those elections, I think, immediately led to what I'm trying to remember the name of the law, but it allowed the party in power to put its opponents in jail if they wrote nasty things in the newspapers.
Yes, it was the Alien Sedition Act, and that law had been passed during Adams's reign. So the as president. So in fact, the writer who had launched the scurrilous attacks against Adams, James Callender, was thrown in jail under the Alien Sedition Act. As was, by the way, a New Jersey, and I live in New Jersey, but so I will say this: a New Jersey tavern patron described John Adams as having a fat butt. And he was heard by his fellow patrons in the tavern and actually thrown in prison for 2 months under the Alien Sedition Act.
Which remained on the books for quite a few years.
Yes.
Let me give the phone numbers again, and we're going to take some calls after our next break. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. We're down to the last three in our top 10, so stick around. If you're in Madison, call us at 263-1890. Again, those numbers, 800-642-1234. That's a toll-free number. In Madison, it's 263-1890. You can also send us an email, as some people like to do. The address is talk@wpr.org. We're talking about dirty tricks in politics, particularly in presidential elections. And I think we'll have enough time before the end of the program to maybe talk a little bit about this election so far and get our guest's perspective on what he's observed so far and maybe compare it to some other things. We've certainly become much more refined in our political trickery over the years and have employed technology cleverly in some of these instances. We'll probably talk about that some too. Anyway, we're going to do all of that and take your calls right after we take this short break. I'm John Munson. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, coming up next hour, we're going to take a look at last night's primary wins by Hillary Clinton in the Democratic primary. And, of course, John McCain put himself over the top in the delegate count. Mike Huckabee is out of the race, and McCain will be the Republican nominee for president, but we will probably spend more of our time talking about the more competitive of those two races with Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. Still neck and neck with Clinton picking up some key victories for her, wins that she absolutely had to have in order to remain viable in the race, according to some of the analysts. Anyway, we'll talk about all of that in the next hour after 8 o'clock. This hour, we're talking about presidential campaigns of the past, and we're reviewing the top 10 dirtiest campaigns, according to the book Anything for a Vote, Dirty Tricks, Cheap Shots, and October Surprises in U.S. Presidential Campaigns, published by Quirk Publishing. And we have the author of that book, Joseph Cummins, joining us by telephone. And let's see, we are up to number three. And again, we're back in the 21st century. We've got George W. Bush versus Al Gore as the number three on our list. And let's talk about that.
You know, it's interesting about this particular election, because when I've done interviews and I've talked to people, some people, depending on their party affiliation, don't believe this should be on the dirtiest election list at all, whereas other people believe it should be the dirtiest election of all time. So, of course, it still generates a great deal of controversy. I think the main issue was this with this election was what happened, of course, in Florida as the votes were being counted, and that depends on what side you're on. I think, basically, when Supreme Court stopped the hand recounting of ballots and handed the victory to George Bush, that was a very partisan action, as were almost all the actions of Catherine Harris, who was the Secretary of State as well as the co-chair of the Republican Party in Florida. However, I don't think the question really has been asked enough, what would the Democrats have done if they were in a position of power in Florida and they had a chance to influence the outcome in regards to the actual recounting of the ballots. Both parties in this case, I think, would probably have acted the same way because they are political animals and they protect themselves first. So it's a very dirty election, but accusing the Republicans of acting in a partisan way is like, you know, accusing a lion of jumping on a gazelle and killing it. I mean, that's just what it does.
So let's see, moving to number two, and this is probably one of my favorites in terms of an interesting election and what was done in it, sort of like watching a train wreck in some ways. You just can't take your eyes off of it. Number two is the 1964 election, Lyndon Johnson versus Barry Goldwater. And, of course, you had the famous Daisy TV ad.
You know, the famous Daisy TV ad, which has come up in the news recently because of Hillary Clinton's It's 3 o'clock in the morning ads against Barack Obama. The Daisy TV ad is the ad where the little girl is seen plucking daisies and innocently counting the petals as they fall off. And suddenly you hear a military countdown. Camera closes in tight on the little girl's pupils. And then when the military countdown gets to one, you see an atomic explosion reflected in her eyes. And then you hear Lyndon Johnson saying, "We must all love one another or we must die, or we will die." And this is, of course, one of these alarmist ads that worked quite well during that election. But one of the reasons, frankly, they worked so well is because Barry Goldwater was an alarming kind of guy. He's the kind of guy who said things like, "Let's toss an A-bomb in the Kremlin and see if we can hit the men's room." So it played into his weaknesses for saying things like that. However, I think this is the second dirtiest election in American history because of the things that Lyndon Johnson did during that election to bring up a huge margin so that he could win by a great deal and have a mandate for his programs. Basically, he instituted something called the 5 o'clock club or the after hours club, which not a lot of people know about. And this group of people met in the executive office building after 5 o'clock and plotted dirty tricks against Barry Goldwater, such as writing hundreds of letters to Ann Landers, the columnist, pretending to be from ordinary citizens who were terrified of a Goldwater presidency. They even released coloring books for little children, which portrayed Goldwater and the rogues of the Ku Klux Klan. You know, moving on to more serious things, they sent E. Howard Hunt, who later figured in the Watergate break-in, but who at the time was an active CIA agent, they sent E. Howard Hunt to infiltrate Barry Goldwater's campaign, which he did successfully, and steal Goldwater's policy speeches and present them to the White House before Goldwater was able to even make the speeches, and therefore the White House had a very ready response to this. And according to J. Edgar Hoover, this hasn't quite been proven, but Hoover later said that Johnson also bugged Goldwater's campaign plane. So.
And of course, you had the famous twisting of Goldwater's campaign line, "In your heart, you know he's right." The Democrats were saying, "In your heart, you know he might," which referred to they were trying to scare people into thinking that Goldwater was going to start a nuclear war.
Right, these were dueling bumper stickers that you would see around the country all over the place.
Exactly. Yeah. But the most interesting and the number one dirtiest campaign of all time, we should have a drum roll here, 1876, Rutherford B. Hayes versus Samuel Tilden, is this one is the granddaddy of all dirty campaigns.
Yeah, this is the really one that I think certifiably stolen election in American history. I don't think anybody has any doubt about this. And it featured the Republican Civil War hero Rutherford B. Hayes against the Democrat crusading DA from New York, Samuel Tilden. And when we get down to the election on election night, the Democrats and Tilden are ahead by a slim plurality, but it looks like they're going to win. All Tilden needs is one electoral vote to put him over the top, and there are plenty of electoral votes for him in the Democratic southern states of Louisiana, South Carolina, and once again Florida. And when the Republicans hear this, they get the Republican returning boards in these states, in other words, the people who control the counting of the electoral votes at that time, and they are able to change the electoral vote. So it turns out that Hayes comes out the victor. As you can imagine, this causes an enormous hue and cry, and there is a great deal of controversy, and finally a group of Supreme Court justices and other prominent men are put on the case to decide who actually wins. But the deck is stacked to the Republicans, and the Republicans do win by one vote, and Hayes becomes president. But it's so contentious and so important in history for this reason. In order to really for the Democrats to accept that, they had to be awarded something. In this case, what happened was that Hayes stopped the Republican administration's efforts at Reconstruction in the South, pulled federal troops out of the South, and basically, I think, and a lot of historians think, set back the case of civil rights in the South for possibly 100 years. So it was a very pivotal election in American history, and it was really a stolen election.
Well, let's shift gears and talk a little bit. We've only got a couple of minutes left, and we have a caller who wants to talk about the current presidential campaign, particularly on the Democratic side. With we've got Obama and Clinton running neck and neck. And let's just take the call and find out what Rick in Sparta has to say. Rick, I appreciate your patience in waiting for us to get to you, but you're on the air now.
Very good. Here in Wisconsin, in the final week before the primary, you saw Clinton going a little bit negative, and then you could see the numbers starting to work for her, and I haven't heard anybody talk about it yet, but on the day of the election, during breakfast news, she came out with an extremely negative ad, going down a laundry list of obviously half-truths and twisted remarks, slamming Obama. And I was just curious if anybody picked up on that. And then secondly, wouldn't it be ironic if John McCain has to resort, either through his own doing or the 527s, in order enough to get enough momentum to win the campaign, for the same reasons it sunk him in the 2000 elections?
I didn't see the ad in question in Wisconsin that you're talking about. However, I definitely agree. Every negative attack ad that I've ever seen is always based on half truths. You know, it's very seldom that you find something that is completely true. But as I was saying earlier in the show, half truths work. This is how, you know, dirty tricks are like, a bunch of neighbors gossiping across their back fences, and they may say that so-and-so down the street's having an affair, and you may not believe that about so-and-so, but, you know, maybe so-and-so was seen walking with a certain man or a woman in the shopping mall, and so there's a little bit of vague truth to it, but there's enough for people to do these campaigns on, and I think Clinton and others have been resorting to a great deal of dirty campaigning during this campaign.
We had I want to make sure I get this in. We had an email from Jane in Appleton about the 2000 election and what you had to say about the Supreme Court being involved. Her contention is that the reason that the Supreme Court of the United States had to get involved was that the Democratic dominated Supreme Court of the state of Florida had usurped its authority and was involving itself in the election on behalf of Al Gore, and that's why the United States Supreme Court had to step in.
Well, this shows you how partisan that is. I disagree with that. I think that this was a state's issue, and I believe that United States, no matter what the makeup of the court in Florida, I believe that this was something that the states should have decided.
Okay, well, we're almost out of time, and I don't want to start anything new. So, but we got through our top 10 list, okay, and And we're all set with that. So I just want to say thank you for spending this time with us, and make a prediction about this. Once the dust has settled and we have two candidates instead of three, what do you think this next campaign is going to be like? And you've got 30 seconds.
I think it's going to break into my top 10 dirtiest tricks list, because here we'll have either a black man running for the first time or a woman running for the first time. And I think it's going to be a really close and contentious contest, and I think both sides are really going to go after each other.
Well, thank you so much for spending the time, and we'll all be watching and maybe adding to this top 10 list, and maybe we'll have you back on next year to talk about it.
Thank you so much, John. I appreciate it.
Joseph Cummins is the author of the book Anything for a Vote: Dirty Tricks, Cheap Shots, and October Surprises in United States Presidential Campaigns. It's published by Quirk. And he obviously joined us by telephone. Stay tuned, because next hour we're going to talk about the current presidential election, particularly, specifically, the primaries that were held yesterday. This program was produced by Karen Prager, who also did on-air production, and I thank her for that. Thank you so much for tuning in. I'm John Munson. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.